This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
This is Drew Neiser, author of Renegade Marketing, 12 Steps to Building Unbeatable B2B Brands, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I do this podcast to help me and my listeners keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow their revenue. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Drew Neiser to talk about his new book, Renegade Marketing, 12 Steps to Building Unbeatable B2B Brands. Drew Neiser is the founder of Renegade, a strategic boutique for B2B innovators, and CMO Huddles, a membership organization exclusively for B2B CMOs. He's also the host of the podcast Renegade Thinkers Unite. Ranked among the top B2B influencers, Drew has been a featured marketing expert on ABC News, CNBC, CBS Radio, and Tony Robbins podcast, among many others. Besides his long-running Ad Age magazine column, he's contributed articles to Fast Company, Forbes, MediaPost, and CMO.com. Drew's first book, The CMO's Periodic Table, A Renegade's Guide to Marketing, published in 2015, features interviews with 64 marketing leaders at top brands, including American Express, Dow, IBM, and SAP. Drew started his advertising career at Wells Rich Green and later moved to J. Walter Thompson and Chiat Day and then founded the agency that became Renegade in 1993. And interesting fact, he's obsessed with and a bit of an expert on American founding father Benjamin Franklin. Drew, congratulations on Renegade Marketing and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. I love your show, and it's just an honor to be with you.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for your kind words, but I am just a knuckleheaded podcaster who can't stop reading these books, and I'm such a fan of people like you who are able to write them. But there are many interesting things about Drew Neiser, okay? First off, you are the very first author I've interviewed who is a graduate of Duke University. Go Blue Devils.
Go Blue Devils. I can't believe it. Not a single one.
I Amazing. Know. Yeah.
Shocking. I'm going to have to make a big point of that. I am the only Dookie. This is like going to go on my epitaph, the only Dookie on Marketing Book Podcast. That's incredible.
Well, I think now that you're here, others will probably follow. They'll start coming out of the woodwork. And it's funny, like for some reason, Stanford grads got a real foothold, and now there's been more authors with Stanford degrees than anywhere else. And it's not something I planned. I didn't run an ad in the Stanford alumni magazine, but a lot of them started coming forward, and it's sort of like, well, maybe they saw someone else, so they said, okay, I'll go on that guy's podcast. But even more importantly, I should say that I guess I'm a Duke fan, amongst many other things, because my mother is a graduate of Duke University. And one of my brothers went there. He's a graduate of Duke, so naturally he was her favorite child, and I can understand that. And I should also, for those folks who live in North Carolina, my mother's two brothers both went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And years ago, when my mother was in her 80s, she passed away. And one of her brothers, who went to Chapel Hill, passed away within 6 weeks of her. And Drew, right up to the very end, he was giving her shit about going to Duke.
Don't blame him. On the other hand, I bet she had the same mug I have, which is the coffee, one of my favorite coffee mugs that says, "Go to hell, Carolina." Oh. That's it. That's just the way it is, you know? I mean, and anytime I hear a university of, you know, North Carolina, fine university, my instinctual reaction is, "Go to hell, Carolina."
I got to get that mug for my brother.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's the greatest.
Yeah. That's terrific. So another thing that was of great interest to me is that you worked at J. Walter Thompson until 1987, I believe. And I think that was the same year they were acquired by WPP.
Yeah, they were actually acquired a little bit earlier.
Okay.
And so I was there when that was happening. And then I spent 1 year at Lord Gelder, Federico, and Einstein, which was owned by JWT when the management team walked out of that agency. But yeah, we just missed each other.
I know. I started there in 1988. And it turns out we both, at one time, worked on the Listerine account.
I want you to know, before this show, I went and gargled with Listerine just in preparation for the show, and I wanted to have good breath on the show.
Thank you.
Can you tell?
Yeah, it's clearer, you don't sound like you have as much plaque or gingivitis. I'm sorry, Listerine jokes. But in fact, to this day, I still use Listerine every day, twice a day, and it's the brown, the amber stuff, the stuff that's 125 years old and... Anyway.
By the way, I do too. And so does my dad, who started using it when I worked on the business.
Excellent. And then, I find all these things. It's like we've had parallel lives. At one point, you worked on the Panasonic account, and I worked on that when I was at Gray. And it turns out we had a lot of friends in common and clients in common. So that was... interesting, and it kind of took me back down memory lane, reading about some of the things that you've done and where you are. So the book has been endorsed by several past guests on the Marketing Book Podcast, and let me mention a couple of them. One of them is Dori Clark, and you even have her endorsement on the cover of your book, which I think was a very good move. She writes, "Drew Neiser's new book unlocks invaluable best practices for B2B marketers. If you want to learn the secret wisdom of nearly 500 top CMOs, pick up this groundbreaking handbook." And she was a recent guest. She was on for the fourth time for episode 350. And then a recent guest is Kimberly Whitler, who's a marketing professor at the Darden School at the University of Virginia. And she, for her book, Positioning for Advantage. And she writes, "Drew has written a provocative book that at once challenges and inspires B2B marketers to reinvent their roles and impact. Written in an artful, easy-to-read narrative style, Drew's book is a perfect reflection of who he is, challenging the status quo in a way that works. A must-read for B2B marketers everywhere." And then I just love looking through the blurbs. I'm just a book nerd, a marketing book nerd. But you also have an endorsement from Michael Brenner, who's been on the show twice. His most recent book is Mean People Suck, which I think is a great book title. John Hall, author of Top of Mind, and even Michael Shine, who is the author of The Hype Handbook. And unlike you, he actually went to Penn, founded by Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So did you develop this interest in Ben Franklin later in life, or was it in high school? And I'm just surprised you didn't go to Penn.
I know. My wife went to Penn, if that's any consolation. Not only she went to undergrad and graduate, so I have some. And I have a picture of myself sitting next to Ben. There's a statue of him on a bench, and so that counts. No, the obsession literally began in 2006 when I started thinking about this idea. At the time, we called it marketing as service. Mm-hmm. And it was just this notion that marketing could be more than words and pictures and so forth. And, you know, shortly thereafter, Jay wrote his book, Utility. Another friend wrote a book called Marketing with Meaning. And as I was going through all this, I found Ben Franklin's saying, well done is better than well said. And for someone like me who spends a lot of time thinking about words, that was the lightning bolt, pun intended. That was the moment that I went, I get it. Everything we're going to do is going to be focused. While we're going to get the words right, we're going to focus on marketing that, you know, is well done. The actions, not the words. So anyway, and it's been an obsession since then. We went to Paris. My wife went off to a chateau. I spent a day touring Franklin's sort of period in France. And one last thing, and then I'll get back to your story, which is Franklin, I consider America's first chief marketing officer.
Yes. Great. I loved it. I'd never seen that.
And it's so true. I mean, here's the marketing challenge. Sell a revolution to a king. Go for it. Off you go.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I guess you've read Walter Isaacson's biography, and I haven't read it, but I remember him saying that he was like the first media entrepreneur. It was so interesting, and I can remember as a kid in 1976 during the bicentennial, there was some article I read about what would the founding fathers think of modern day life in, you know, the United States or in the world, and they said Ben Franklin would like it the most.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say that. I mean, there's a great scene where he's older. He's quite old. He's in France, and the first hot air balloon is going up there, and there's a demonstration. And someone says to Franklin, or he overhears them say, well, what good is that? That's not going to do anything. And what Franklin said was, what good is a baby? And it was such a brilliant in understanding. He so embraced technology. And I think that was his one, you know, if he had a regret, it was like, I can't live forever because I can't experience all this cool stuff that's going to happen.
Yes. And he would have been the most comfortable. He could have said, I saw this coming. He might not have said that, but it would make perfect sense to him. So very, very interesting person. And it's even inspired me to want to go read that book or whatever Ben Franklin biographies that you recommend.
You got it. I got a long list. I think there's a couple that are better than Isaacson. So I'll share those with you after the show.
Oh, great. Thank you. So the introduction for the book was written by none other than Brent Adamson. Unbelievable. Now, he's the co-author of The Challenger Sale and The Challenger Customer. And I actually got to spend a couple of days with him a few years back after I had interviewed Pat Spener, one of his co-authors for The Challenger Customer. And I wasn't quite sure what it was. And I thought it was going to be like a small, you know, event where you'd sit in the audience and they would be talking about some of the interesting things that Gartner was doing at the time they were CEB. And it turned out it was only like 12 of us in a room with him and Matthew Dixon and some of the other folks that he wrote these books with. And it, with the exception of me, almost all the other people in the room were authors. Some of them I had interviewed, others I had met, and I got to tell you, it was like being a kid at NFL fan day. I couldn't believe I was in the room with these folks, and they were all so smart, and it was a really amazing experience for me. Now, I want to start out with a few things from the back of the book. Now, Drew doesn't know I'm going to do this, but I don't have a lot of books on the show about brands and branding. Some, but not a whole lot. And it, in part because I've seen enough of them, or a few of them, they just smell too much like arts and crafts party planning. This one doesn't. And, you know, it's Bob Hoffman, the ad contrarian, who you probably know. He's been on the show 4 times. He's a real curmudgeon. And he's famous for saying there's no bullshit like brand bullshit. And that's sort of my you know, my litmus test when I look at it. But I want to quote from the last part of your book, which we'll get into a bit later, and explain why I tend not to have those kind of books. And these, you tackle this head on. So I want to quote from, let's see, I'm going to start with page 111. And this is the section of the book about the scientific approach, the measurement and all that type of thing. You write, the CMO who doesn't know how to translate marketing speak into financial speak is unlikely to be taken seriously. And then a couple pages later, you quote Jeffrey Hazlett, the founder of the C-Suite Network and the former CMO of Kodak. And he said, a lot of CMOs fail because they forget the conditions of satisfaction. In other words, they have not nailed down the key measures of success and therefore will have little chance of demonstrating the value of their contribution. This seems like an obvious thing, but you'd be surprised how few marketers have metrics of success in place at the start of their new position. Then I want to go to page 120. This is for those playing the home game. You write that B2B CMOs, especially those at venture-backed software companies, are a clever lot. and listeners to this show too. When joining their peers in the C-suite or when presenting to their investors or boards, you will rarely hear them utter the word brand or tie a budget item to brand building. And then one last quote from page 125, you write, CMOs who don't try to measure marketing's impact on revenue are CMOs who won't be in their positions for an extended period. So I hope you understand why I'm putting that out there. It's also really, really important for marketers. So when you see a book that talks about building a brand and it has information like that in it, don't worry. Okay. So let's go back to the beginning of the book and let me ask you a really big question. Drew Neiser, what does it take to be a renegade marketer? What have you finally discovered about what it takes?
First of all, I want to mention Brent Adamson. I'm such a fanboy of his, and I had a very similar experience to what you were talking about. And it's just his energy and his approach is just, it really opens your eyes. So those of us who've been lucky enough to be in the room with him, it's just an incredible experience. So,
amen.
And I was, when he said yes to writing the foreword, it was like, I did the happy dance for about an hour.
That's a really big deal.
It's a big deal.
And you know what? It's a really good introduction too. Oh man.
Sometimes, and I have had him on my podcast four times, which felt like a blessing enough.
Yeah.
So, anyway, for him to do that, I'm just a shout out to Brent. He's just phenomenal. And anytime any marketer gets a chance to, or salesperson gets a chance to hear him, they should. So,
but when Duke plays Michigan and beats them in basketball, don't yes. rub it in.
Okay. No, we won't even cover that ground, at all. We'll just get right back to, how to buy. So, okay. How to become a renegade marketer. So in the book.
And I'll be back in about 45 minutes to see how you're doing.
I'm going to need some help with this. And by the way, I'm so glad you started where you did with that, because I really do think that brand is a fluffy term. And by the way, I've got this thing called CMO Huddles, which you mentioned. And this month we focused on that topic of brand and do you talk about it and do you not and do you measure it? And it's fascinating because about 80% will say, I don't call it brand. So that's part one of this thing. But anyway, back to being a renegade marketer. You know, having interviewed all these CMOs, and this came out of after the first book, which is, what are the four traits that really consistently will get you to success? And the key thing here is, if you don't have all four of these, one way or another, it's not going to work out for you.
So, right. And I found it so interesting that it's just those four. You could have had 95.
I could have had 95. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, Franklin had his 13 virtues and so forth. And I could have had more. And there are lots of people who've added more. But when you break this down and you start with courageous strategy and say, yeah, if you don't have one, if you don't dare to be distinct, you're not going to, it's, first of all, you're not going to have a story to tell. And second of all, you won't make a difference in your job. So that's big picture stuff. And then from an artful ideation standpoint, the key thing there is not that you're artistic. The key thing is that you're an artful communicator and embrace the team effort. And I'll just give you one quick example. The first thing I recommend to every new CMO is to field an employee survey.
Yes.
The first day. And you'd be surprised when I recommend that they'll do it, but a lot of them don't do
yes.
it. And it's so easy and it's free. It kills me. So,
and we're going to talk about that because that really struck me as really great advice. We'll get to that though.
So, and then the third part of this thing is this execution, right? Obviously, you have to execute, but I add the word thoughtful because, again, we go back to this notion that we used to call marketing as service, but that if you are thoughtful and you're really thinking about things, you'll say, you know what? We got to engage employees first because they're the front line. We mm-hmm. then have to go to customers. And then finally, when we actually go out and tell the story of the brand, we do it in a form of service, period, end of story. And then lastly, but firstly, because you brought it up, if you don't have the right metrics in place, who cares what you did? It won't matter. You're done. So the scientific method, but the coolest part of the scientific method, and it's so great because I can go back to Franklin on all this because he was a big scientist so many ways, is it, you get from, okay, let's get the metrics, but then let's talk about marketing automation and how much money you're wasting there.
Right.
Yes. And then finally, we can have this liberating moment where we say, you know what? We can test, and we can test all sorts of great, cool things, and we can make some little bets that'll become big bets. And so I love the fact that we can go from this big picture strategy to these, the scientific method, and end with something that is kind of exciting and makes the business cool. And it's funny, you were talking about our time at JWT and Gray and Rennie. The business was really fun back then. Right. We were in the business when it was fun.
But let me just interrupt for a second there. People don't appreciate how hard it is to go to 3 martini lunches.
I don't think he was there by the time you got there, but there was one gentleman whose name is going to escape me, who was a 3 martini lunch guy. He was the son-in-law of Reynolds, as in Reynolds Wrap, and they had the business. I don't know if they still had it when you were there, but it was close. Anyway, this gentleman would go for his 3 martini lunch. He would literally leave at about 10:45. They put a telephone on his table. They'd bring his martinis, and then he'd come back, and he had a secretary, because that's what she was called, who was told when he came back, no calls, and he would go into his office, turn the blinds down, and put his feet up on the desk and nap.
Well, Drew, you say that like it's all a bad thing. That's exactly what I did.
There you go.
No. So it was fun. It was exciting. I guess you could argue it was the tail end of the Mad Men era. It was a different time. So now those four things you mentioned, courageous, artful, thoughtful, and scientific. There's an acronym there, which is CATS. And I'm a terrible singer, but I'm now going to sing Memories from CATS. No, I'm kidding. As a favor to my audience, I'm not going to do that. But I was thinking about dropping that in here, and I just thought, you know, let's not irritate Drew. Let's pay respect to his book. So, believe it or not, now that I'm no longer working in an office, we're all working remotely, I have actually been forced to pay attention to my home. 1908 house here in Virginia, and you know, having all kinds of work done to it. And I have been, I've actually read Marie Kondo's book about clearing away the clutter, and it really makes you feel good. What do I see at chapter one? The title is Clear Away the Clutter. And I want you to explain this. You write, marketing has become way more complicated, but rarely more effective. Be the Marie Kondo of marketing. Simplicity and focus are your new besties. Drew Neiser, please explain what you're talking about.
Oh my God. And this just kills me. So we did some research, and we had a theory 4 years ago that marketing was getting ridiculously complicated, but we weren't sure. And we weren't sure if it was getting more effective. So we did a survey among 150 in the first year CMOs and said, is marketing getting more complicated, you know, than the last 12 to 24 months? 90% or 80 to 90% said, absolutely. It wasn't strongly agree. I mean, it was a huge confirmation that it got complex. What we weren't seeing is a correlation to effectiveness. And that's sort of what got me started down the road to do this book, which was, could we radically simplify B2B marketing? Is there any way? Because I would go in to talk to a client and they'd say, could you help us with a messaging grid? We have 14 personas and we'd like to write out very detailed personas and what the sales pitch should be for those personas. I'm thinking, no sales guy could remember those things. No sales guy could implement it. And they have no idea. They can't in one sentence, you know, describe the brand. So what are you really asking them to do? So anyway, clearing away the clutter is both a commitment as a leader that you are going to focus your activities, because you can't be effective if you don't focus, period, right? In anything you want to do. If you try to do everything, you're going to do nothing. And it's so obvious, but I have to say, dealing with as many CMOs that I do, is they really struggle to clear away the clutter. So I just wanted to put that up front and center and say, this is like, you don't get to pass go. If you can't do this, don't bother reading the rest of the book.
Right. Yes.
Because you're not going to be able to implement any of these things. And, you know, one of the things I say in that chapter at the end of it is, you know, if you have a list and you add something to it, you have to take something off.
Right? Nobody does that.
Nobody does it. And this is the hardest part of this. And it's really easy for me to say, and I empathize with CMOs so much.
Yeah.
Is that the CEO will be, you know, have the idea of the month because they listen to a podcast or they talk to a friend or their wife gave them some input.
Or as I like to call it, management by in-flight magazine.
Exactly. And they'll suggest something. And the CMO, all they have to do is say, great idea. We'll put that on we'll think about putting that on the plan for Q4. But as you know, we agreed in our strategic plan that these were our three priorities. And these are the things that we're doing to deliver those priorities. And I'm assuming your business priorities haven't changed.
Great answer. Oh, please, listeners, come back with that. Now, you do have to have a plan and
a strategy. And that's, and that's where we get to the next chapter is, you know, let's start to think about what that plan will look like. And it's so obvious and it's so easy. But I just, when I was thinking about, and again, this comes from a place of empathy. I know CMOs and how hard their job is. And I frankly, any marketer, forget CMO, any marketer or any entrepreneur who's trying to get a handle on what their marketing should do and could do, start there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in the next chapter, you have an expression about marketing is execution. In other words, like it's a popular perception, go do it. And I wanted to ask you to explain and perhaps inspire the listeners with a quote from chapter 11, where you write, as the marketer, you have an opportunity to transform your entire organization, not just the words and images that are used in your communications. Explain what you mean there.
Well, so this is, again, where this gets really tricky. And remember, you started at the very end of this with a scientific method. So what happens with a CMO who comes in, the CEO says, drive revenue, right? So what they think about is, oh, well, we have to sell more products. So they get to this demand gen idea, and they say, this is all I want to do is just drive demand. But there's this thing called employees and these folks called customers and a product. And all of those things have to come together in a way, in a unified way.
Right? And an experience the customers have.
Yeah. So what we're simply talking about is and this was tricky because when you and I worked on Panasonic, basically the US operation was handed products and said, go figure out.
Absolutely. Yes.
That was the way it was. Mm-hmm. But today, a marketer can actually sit down with a product marketing team in advance and say, let's bake in some marketing into this idea. You know?
Based on my understanding of the customers and our competition and so forth and so on, rather than being very product or service oriented.
Right. And it's again, this is pretty commonsensical. And so in the book, I try to really give practical ways of doing that. And so let's, for example, say you agreed with me and day one, you did that employee survey. And let's say you find out there are four dimensions that you are not delivering on and employees are really unhappy and they don't understand what the brand is. You know what? You can fix that. You, the marketer, can fix that. And when you do that, there's a chance you might even transform your customer relationships because everybody knows happy employees are happy customers. You don't have happy customers without happy employees. So this stuff, it's just thinking about your marketing role as transformative.
Yes.
It's such a valuable opportunity. And CMOs that are really good at their jobs are driving change in their organizations.
Absolutely. And one of my favorite books, and I should be careful saying that because the one thing about this podcast is I get to pick which books are on. So I really like all of them, except for a couple interviews that I didn't publish. But the thing I want to mention is there's a book by Barta and Barwise, and it's called The 12 Powers of a Marketing Leader. And it doesn't mean it's a marketer who's shouting out commands to a platoon of Marines. It's what you're describing right there. These really successful modern marketers are walking the halls. They're sort of evangelizing. They're helping to teach and guide the organization, and the companies are very receptive to it. You know, that a lot of these folks don't come from a marketing background. So there's a lot more power and influence that marketers can have. And the reason I wanted to talk about that is because you've probably seen this, and I certainly have, where there's sort of an attitude of maybe a minority of marketers who, well, that's what they told me to do, you know, or, you know, they just told me to sit in the cubicle and design the trade show booth. Well, you're not going to be a marketer for long, and you're not going to be very happy doing that. You know, there are great opportunities for you to start to quietly influence and guide the organization, and you'll start to get a place at the table, the strategic table. So,
amen. First of all, I love Barta's book, it's just what I love about it is they did a tremendous amount of research among a lot of them, and so if you are a CMO, you can sort of see what characteristics matter and where the leverage is going to be. That was point one. Point two on this thing is you mentioned about most people in an organization don't have marketing experience. It's for CEOs, less than 20% have any marketing experience in their careers.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Like, I guess it was S&P 500 companies and the FTSE 100. It was just, it's very small. Kim Whitler writes about this a lot.
Exactly.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention about Marie Kondo and clearing away the clutter, it's like the signal to noise ratio for marketers is probably like 1 to 100. And the more that you can focus on that signal instead of all the distractions and things you're being asked to do every day, and it's really important. Try to find the signal. So let's move on to page 14 about messaging. And you write that about being distinctive and developing a distinctive and perhaps unique brand strategy for your business. You write that there are usually three basic dimensions to explore first: what you do, how you do it, and for whom you do it. And I'd like you to tell us the story about the company that your apartment building hired for renovations.
Oh, I love that story. And it's just such an amazing moment because sometimes, you know, you think, oh, my company's really boring. We're just in the construction business. There's nothing that we can really do to differentiate our brand. And so I was on the co-op board of our co-op where we live. I was on it for 14 years. About halfway through, we realized we needed to do a hallway renovation. So the board of seven of us, not one of us had ever gone through this before. So what happens is managing agent goes and finds three contractors who bid on the job, and then they come in and they present to you. And so the first one comes in and he says, we ask him a question. So what do you guys do? And say, well, we do hallways, we do restaurants, we do office buildings. Great. And well, what's your method? And he said, well, we start at the bottom and work our way up. And is anything else? And they go, nope, that's it. Okay, great. Second person comes in and says exactly the same thing. We go, oh, okay, well, this is the way it's going to be. Third person comes in. It's John Marino from JPMB Construction. And I'll never forget it. We ask him, so what do you guys do? He said, we only do hallways and co-ops. What? Wait, what? You only do hallways and co-ops? And we say, yeah. And oh, by the way, before we could even ask another question, he says, here are the 10 emails that you're going to want to send to your co-op owners. Because let me tell you this, the biggest complaint is dust. And so guess what? We put 10% of our budget into cleanup. And we even have special sanders that have these vacuums on it. So there is less dust. And these are the emails that you're going to go. So,
and they clean up like at the end of each day too.
Every day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as a board, it was like, oh, wait, we're not in a hallway. We're not looking for someone to do the construction. We're looking for someone to minimize the complaints. Mm-hmm. It like completely shifted the way we thought about it. And anyway, easiest decision. Oh, by the way, when we asked him, what's your process? He said, well, you always start at the top and work your way down because gravity is your friend. And go, okay, great. So he differentiated on the who, right? But what was interesting is by differentiating on the who, as in co-ops and condos, he also ended up differentiating on the how mm-hmm. because of the process. And then later on, and this is the part that really stuck with me, I said, after the meeting, I said, John, so what's the story? Have you always done just co-ops and condos and hallways? He goes, no, we used to be a general contractor. And he said, oh, that must have been a little scary. How was it? He said, it was terrible at first. We had to turn business down. We had to walk away from deals. And then I said, so how is it now? He says, pretty great.
You mean he had to turn down business after they decided to specialize?
Exactly.
Okay.
So, right. And this is the hard part of it is this is where focus is often painful because you're going to say no to something and you're going to turn something down. But then I said, how is it today? He said, pretty darn good because here's the deal. We get invited to almost every bid and we win 70% of them. And we're always the lowest bidder because we're so efficient because that's all we do. And we have teams that are ready. And the funniest part of this story is we decided to pull one aspect of the project out of his budget because it was like 10,000 more. It was the doorknobs. And we said, oh, we'll get, Home Depot to do it. It was a disaster. It was a disaster. So we saved $10,000, but oh my God, we're still dealing with the stupid doorknobs that we had installed by, no offense to Home Depot. It was just not the same as everything else. So yeah, focus is your friend. But it's a hard decision. And this is really hard. If you're a business owner and you're saying, hey, we're doing these five things right now, you're going to go, wait, I'm going to give up 20% of that? Yeah. And by the way, I heard recently, I was interviewing the CMO of SADA System, and this is public so I can share it. They're a cloud software company. They work within clouds to help companies like if you're on AWS or Microsoft or Google. They made a decision a couple years ago to only do Google. They literally cut off 60, 70% of their marketplace. Their business has grown exponentially.
Mm. And I noticed in your book's website, you've got all kinds of resources, and we're going to include links to it at this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. You actually have a list of books that you recommend. And as I was reading this story about JMPB Enterprise, I was reminded of David C. Baker's excellent book, The Business of Expertise, which is on that recommended list. And it's so for folks that want to go even further in that direction, that's a great read. So it's like one more thing. We're brothers from another mother here in terms of our outlook and the books that we have found great inspiration from. Now, you do talk about purpose, as it relates to marketing. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. Mm-hmm. And it was even brought up in Grant Leboff's book, Myths of Marketing, where he says, he explains what it means and why there's a lot of misunderstanding about it. And in your book, you write, you don't have to promise to save the world to have a meaningful brand purpose. Okay? Did everybody hear that? So can you explain the concept of big P and little p of purpose?
Yeah. And this is one that I've struggled with, frankly, for our agency. I mean, we have a marketing agency and, our logo is a saw, and we've had cut through has been our promise since the beginning. It's a little P purpose. It is. We're not saving the world. We're just saying to marketers, we'll help you cut through and our processes will cut through. And it's very clear and to the point, but it's little P purpose. Whereas now for CMO huddles, I have a big P purpose. I believe CMOs can change the world. If I can help them, here's the process that works. You have to first show that you can drive revenue. Then you can begin to talk about purpose in your organization and what that means. So then I have a purpose with CMO huddles. That's big P. So the difference is, look, Tough Book, which I talk about in the book, had a little P purpose. It's like save your computers, the stuff inside it, right? You can drop it, you can run a home over it, and it will survive. And that's really important to people who are road warriors and out in the field. It's not save the world, but it's a really clear and undeniable purpose that was actually baked into the name. Big P purpose is much more complicated. and it's harder, and it's not even necessarily a differentiator, like in REI's case and everybody in the mountaineering world, right? They're all out to save the world, and God bless them for that, but it doesn't differentiate the brand. On the other hand—
And I would like to thank you for not including REI as a case study in this book. Yeah. It's in every other marketing book.
I know. We're trying to bring something fresh here. And so the case that I did bring, and this is really fascinating because it's important and it speaks back to this other issue of sometimes these decisions cost you money. Bank of the West decided to differentiate on a big P purpose. They weren't going to, they talk about this idea that your money has currency is not the right term, but your money, where your money goes when you give it to a bank matters. And so what they decided to do was divest $1.5 billion of assets that they were currently managing for companies that did fracking. Okay. It cost them $1.5 billion in assets. Now, the good news is they picked up business on the other side for businesses who wanted a bank with a bank that had a purpose. So this is one of those things where sometimes your purpose is going to alienate some, but you know you're going to also activate your passionate customers. So, and Kim Whitler and I debate this at length, by the way.
Yes, and she just published an article in the MIT Sloan Review about this. So, and I'll include a link to that to this episode's website as well. So, yeah, but it's a good debate.
It is a good debate. And I think the answer is that it depends on the company and the situation. But I do think there are companies out there where, like I've talked to companies, I don't mention them in the book, but that have where they really are an employee first company. They exist for their employees. That's a big P purpose. Mm-hmm. And that translates into everything that they do and it shows up in their marketing. And so the whole point of the book is not have a purpose. The whole point of the book is have a focus. Right. That you can then bring to life. Purpose just happens to be one of those things. Sometimes it's so hard to find a way of differentiating your brand. And sometimes purpose can do it.
Yes.
And so that's why we have to go there. And if you can't get to big P purpose, you should be able to get to little P purpose. And I think there's lots of value in thinking of it that way.
And that's why I find that such an important distinction, because I think there's way too many folks that think it has to be saving the world. So, one more reason to put your toe in the water there. So you had some, great advice for marketers. And I wanted to ask you about what's on page 37 here. You talk about, some things that, a CMO, particularly new CMOs, should do immediately. Of course, we talked about the employee survey, which we'll talk about in a minute. But you recommend befriend your HR leader, befriend your CFO, and befriend your head of sales. Great, solid gold advice. Explain why.
Again, this is where we're accepting. Hopefully, you've come along on the journey and you've accepted the fact that marketing can be more than pretty pictures and words, that it can actually have a major impact on the organization. And it's about alignment. Well, you don't get there without first, and I start with the HR leader because I also think that employees are the first place you go to do your marketing. Because if it does, both to get the information, but also will it resonate? Because if employees don't believe it, end of story, don't run the campaign. So,
well, it's also a litmus test.
It is. And honestly, I talk about that a lot in the book is marketing is a series of actions that make your promise real. Okay. So if you have a new promise and your employees they haven't been trained to deliver on the promise, then you've just put paint on an old barn and, it's yes. Just not going to do anything. So anyway, so you're going to befriend your head of HR because they might think that you're going to be in their territory by wanting to take over employee communications. You're not. What you are doing is saying, brand and the way we market will have an impact on how you recruit and how we retain and how we go position our product in the future. You and I need to be best buds. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's part one. And right now, because there's such a crisis in recruiting and retention, they're all ears. I mean, they are having a crisis right now at almost every certain companies that I talk to.
Okay. Yes. And your brand is a big driver of their recruitment efforts.
Oh, totally. I mean, who wants to go to a company they haven't heard of? Yeah. You can't tell your mom, oh, I went to work for this company and, you know, and well, who's that? And so awareness matters there, but also you go to the website and if it's boring, you go, oh, this is a boring company. If there's no personality in the brand, it's like, oh, this is going to be boring. And that's, people want to work for companies that they can believe in. And by the way, this is where purpose sometimes really is powerful, mm-hmm. is if they believe that the culture is doing something good in the world and has some focus to it, they're much more likely to say yes. And sometimes they'll take it as that'll be the deal breaker. Mm-hmm. Versus money. They just like the culture of the company and think they'll fit in better or be able to contribute more. So HR is first stop. And then the CFO. And you know, remember, you started this conversation with metrics.
Yeah.
That's why we go to the CFO, because we're going to get the CFO to work with you to define the metrics that matter for the organization. So when you go and present a budget, your CFO is there because the CFO believes in those metrics because they help create them. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, the CFO is sitting there in the meeting with the C-suite when you're all together going, yeah. You know, it's fourth quarter, cut your budget.
Yeah.
But instead, I've talked to a number of CMOs who've done this and they're like best friends. We did an event where we had three CFOs on there and the relationship of the CMO and the CFO was so phenomenal. And you could just tell the CFO would actually go to the CMO and say, by the way, we've got some dry powder. I think we could use it to drive some more revenue this quarter. What do you think? That's not a conversation you hear very often.
Yes.
And that's the conversation you want, is the CFO comes to understand that marketing is a toolkit, an investment there, just like it would be hiring more people or bringing in more sales or more equipment.
Yeah, right? It's a revenue lever that can be adjusted. And not to keep talking about Kim Whitler, but I do know she's a listener. She has a really interesting story in her book, Positioning for Advantage, about the relationship she had with a CMO. They're still friends, and how effective that became at growing that company's business.
Yeah, it's critical. It really is. And I'm always shocked when I don't find that. And so, and then lastly, this head of sales, and here I can tell a story. It's not in the book, but I love this.
You're saying is this is a marketing book podcast extra?
Exactly.
I hope your listeners appreciate that.
And this is really an interesting and important moment and lesson for this CFO, a CMO. So the CMO, first time presenting to a board of directors, goes to the board and says, look at my great numbers. I am driving leads into the system. My team is killing it. Here are all the good things that we're doing. And a board member says, huh. So you're saying that because we're not hitting our numbers, so that sales is just dropping the ball?
Oh.
And it was like, uh-oh, yeah, that's probably what I was saying. Yeah, he never made that mistake again. And what I love now is, like, this guy, when he goes in to present to the C-suite, he is in lockstep with the salesperson, so much so they write the presentation together. They give it together or they take turns doing it. So you can't separate marketing from sales. And this is just a seamless thing. And so that building that relationship, I mean, the days, and it's not that long ago where marketing and sales, that divide was so huge. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, marketing's useless. They're not doing anything. Give us all that money and we'll hire more salespeople. Mm-hmm. And then the salespeople are useless because, you know, they're just not following up on all the leads we're giving. That is almost gone.
Really?
Almost gone. Yeah.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah. But now, you know, they're fighting over different things now. But you know, a good salesperson knows he needs air cover. Well, what's air cover? It's awareness and understanding. What's that come from? Marketing.
Yeah. So the relationship used to be like Duke and Carolina fans. And that has not changed, but the sales and marketing is warming up. It's still a big, big challenge, though, from everything I read and for what I hear from listeners. And almost every week, people are asking me for book recommendations or resources on how to start to tackle that. This podcast, I've had over 50 books about sales, and I love it. I think I get some of my greatest marketing ideas from reading sales books, but also the really great marketers, my sense is that they have a deep understanding of sales and the sales process, what the salespeople are dealing with, but even more importantly, what the friction is for the buyer and what the buyer motivations are. And you have, again, solid gold recommendation. I just want to quote from this. You write, start by going on a sales call as an observer, but then do a sales presentation on your own. Your sales chief will appreciate your effort to walk in his or her shoes. From there, you can start to break down any sales versus marketing tension. Marketing is hard enough without this unnecessary yet age-old conflict. I have had some authors of sales books saying, you know, marketers should spend at least one day a month with salespeople. So, and there was another book, Rise of the Revenue Marketer by Debbie Gagish, and she talked about, in that interview, about a company, and in her book as well, I can't remember which one, but anyone they hired for marketing first had to spend 3 months in sales.
Yeah, so, I love that.
Yeah, it's a great idea. So just to go back one more time to this issue of engaging employees before launching a marketing effort, I seem to recall you mentioned some research with CMOs where a lot of them, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of them realize you should do that, but most of them aren't because they don't have any time. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that killed me. This hurt me. It was like, oh no, please, maybe we could do the study again. And 2 years in a row, 80% strongly agree that engaging with employees before launching a new campaign is really important to the success of the campaign. So then we said, so how long do you usually allow for this kind of stuff? And they'll say, well, less than 4 weeks. And to me, what that signals is, oh, you're just going to show them the ad in the town hall. That's right. And so what the book talks about is this story about Aetna and how they spent 6 months retraining their employees so they could launch a new campaign that said, you don't join us, we join you, because mm-hmm. the promise was that we'll know you and we'll help you a little bit more. And so in order to deliver on that promise, they had to retrain the employees. So when you call in and say, hey, I need knee surgery, the customer service agent will say, oh, okay, well, we'll approve that surgery. And by the way, here are the PT. Would you like some recommendations for some PT, physical therapy people? Because normally people after knee surgery need that. It's like, that's a transformative moment, right? You don't get there. So marketing is driving a massive amount, a new commitment, mm-hmm. right? A new promise. And then they're reorganized. They're literally training the employees to deliver it. And this is the difference between sort of marketing that really matters and marketing that is fluff. If you are transforming your organization to deliver on your promise, then you're going to kill it.
Well said. So true. And in the chapter on engagement, you talk about engaging employees as not an optional luxury for renegade marketers. And then on page 79, you go on and list like some things, bullet pointed list of things that you could be doing to engage employees. I would think the HR folks would like this too. And the very first bullet point, Drew Neiser, is start an employee book club in which everyone reads the same book each month. Now, I'm pretty sure this book's going to reach a second edition. So if you could, I don't need an answer right now, but if you could think about I just want you to think about adding to this where it says start an employee book club in which everyone reads the same book each month, comma, and listens to the Marketing Book Podcast. Just an idea. I don't need an answer right now.
All in.
Yeah, thank you.
All in. It's done. Second edition. Boom. It's in there.
Okay, great. So I want to go to the very next page where we talk about customers. And you write, it seems obvious. This is Cultivate Customer Champions. And you write, it seems obvious enough. Every B2B company is in the business of acquiring new customers and keeping current ones for as long as possible. And typically, the business priorities are written in exactly that order. In this book, we recommend switching the order and focusing on your current customers before prospects. Drew Neiser, Why? It's such a revolutionary idea.
I know. Well, look, so here's the deal. 80 to 90% of a marketer's budget is focused on prospects. That's just the way, and that kills me.
Yes.
And it kills me because, what the problem is, and the reason they have to spend so much on that is that they don't have enough case histories. They don't have enough customers that are really willing to help partner in building a community of customers. So what we just talk about is, okay, so we've got our employees engaged. They're really well-trained. Now, how do we cultivate customers? And this came to a head. And by the way, I had this book written prior to the pandemic, but I put it on hold because I wasn't sure if the principles would still apply. I wasn't sure what would change. And so what was fascinating about the pandemic was folks first figured out that they had to figure out how they could be essential, right? They had to be that because everybody else was being rejected. But what enlightened marketers did was saying, they pulled up, they hugged their customers, not their haters. Sorry, Jay. They hugged their customers. And I know one CMO, and I think I talk about it in the book, who literally called every one of their customers and talked about, okay, what are your challenges? What are you doing? How can we help? It changed the relationship. And so that became the save strategy during the first early days of the pandemic when nobody knew. But, you have to ask, why don't you do that all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I saw that in the book, though, I can remember writing. I can't remember which page it is, but I wrote, "Are they not?" A separate part of the book, you talk about how the, like you said, 90%. It's on customer acquisition, and I wrote off to the side, "Are they not marketing to their current customers? Are they not even selling or trying to sell more to the customers that probably already know, like, and trust them?" It just seems like it's faster revenue too, isn't it?
It is. It goes back to this metrics thing. What are they measured on?
Yeah.
And you'll do what you're measured on.
Yeah.
And if everybody, and now I do know, and again, some of the CMOs that I've talked to since the book came out said, look, we look at revenue, not just as revenue, new customers, but also upsell, cross-sell. And that's how we're rewarded. What you still, even when they say that, they're still not saying we're going to, well, okay, so 30% of our revenue is coming from renewals and upsells and cross-sells, so we should put 30% of the budget in there. Instead, they have this thing called customer success, which is really inside sales, and not customer experience and customer support. So anyway, bottom line on this is, I don't exactly know, but I do know that a light bulb went off in March of 2020 among a lot of B2B brands who realized that, first thing we got to do is, secure the horses in the corral.
Right.
There's a storm coming and we got to get them safe.
Maybe even call your customers and ask how they're doing.
Yeah. And they did. And again, it was sort of empathy and it was, hey, we're all in this together. And some went as far as say, I know you might be cash strapped. We'll suspend the payment. And they got something back for it. They got renewals. They got, they extended the contract. Or the one who said, I won't do a testimonial when you said, hey, we'll delay payments for 2 months. You want a testimonial? All of those things started to change the relationship to make it easier to get champions. And it's just ironic. It took a pandemic and our sort of the classic kind of recession behavior where you go, oh, customers, right.
I forgot about them.
Right, yeah. Right.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. So that's really important. Now, let's go back. We're starting to circle back here to Ben Franklin. Please explain the concept of selling through service. You mentioned earlier that you all referred to it as marketing through service, but talk about selling through service.
Yeah, so we've been living with this idea of marketing as service. And part of this, by the way, just comes back to me wanting to sort of, if we're going to be marketers, but we're going to make a difference by not just putting, pollution. And I think I shared a video with you that we did back in 2007.
I know, you guys were really prescient. And it was, it's still true.
It's still true.
Yeah.
Now, we renamed it as sell through service because all the chapters are alliterative and marketing through service isn't. So that's inside baseball. But selling through service comes from Franklin. Well done is better than well said. We've got our purpose-driven story statement, which defines the brand. We say we're going to do six things that brings that to life that are of value. This is right? That actually deliver value to employees, customers, and prospects in that order. And by the way, we have this thing called plan on a page, one purpose-driven story statement, and then you can get this whole thing, talking about clear away the putt, you can get this whole plan. And selling as service extends into lots of different forms of marketing. But, you know, if we go back to Brent Adamson, where he says buying is broken, selling through service becomes about sales enablement. How do you make it easier for the customer to get to a decision? And there's lots of things you can do. And I quote Adamson a lot in the book, but there are other things. It's a philosophy that marketing can be about the value that you're bringing to the table as opposed to messaging. And this is the thing that kills me, and we used to get it, and we won't do that kind of work anymore, where someone says, hey, we need a messaging grid. It's like, no. You need a service grid. You need a number of things that you can do that will help someone actually be interested in having a conversation with you because you've really made their life easier at a moment when they need something. And it's not a complicated, you know, Jay's book, Utility, speaks to that. You know, that was a long time ago.
Like 2014 or,
yeah.
And Alex, I'll include a link to his interview and also his other one, Hug Your Haters.
Yeah.
Jay Baer is almost like a ghost, guest host, co-host for me because his books keep getting written, but it's so true. Being of service, and it brought to mind this one funny exchange I had with a client a couple years ago where they were saying, okay, we're ready to start doing some email marketing. And we were talking about what they had in mind, and they said, well, we'd like to talk about our products and some of the projects we've been doing. I'm just thinking, where's the value? I mean, come on, boss. Even your mom doesn't want to read that. and she loves you and is proud of you. Yeah. So, and actually, just to quote from page 100, the sell-through service mindset requires marketers to put customers at the center of the universe. Sacre bleu.
So let me give you an example of selling through service. There's a couple, but my favorite all time, and it starts with a story that's not completely in the book. This was for HSBC. They came to us and said, hey, we're thinking about having street teams give away little statues of liberty. This is a true story. And on the street, what do you think? Will you help us? Because at that time, Renegade was known as a guerrilla marketing agency. This was in the early 2000s. And we said, huh. Okay, I'm sure your customers will really care about getting little statuettes. So you're talking about people putting money in your bank, and they wanted, the reason, the idea behind it is they really had this idea, the world's local bank. They wanted to appear as if they were a local bank. So we came back to them in the framework of marketing a service and said, here's an idea. You want to be associated with New York? We're going to create a program called the Bank Cab, featuring checker cabs, which are an iconic New York thing. We're going to do a search for the most knowledgeable cab driver in New York, which often felt like an oxymoron at that time. And we're going to put them on the road, and we're going to give free rides to HSBC customers.
This was in the book.
Yeah, no, but the story behind how we got to that idea. The part about the giving away.
Yeah, they were kind of self-diagnosing and telling you what they wanted, and you came back and said, okay, now that we understand, we think this is what you actually need versus what you want.
Exactly. And so that program ran for years and years and years, and somebody would get this free ride, which, you know, in New York is like, you get something free. It's like, oh my God, I won the lottery. But it's a luxurious cab, and the cab driver, Johnny Morello, who won this contest, actually was genius about New York. I mean, he knew everything. You could ask him anything about it, and he knew it. A bigger idea in the world of B2B is Small Business Saturday. It's just an incredible program. That is selling through service. They created a movement that they've just sort of gifted to the small business world, whether you're an American Express customer or not. So between Black Friday and Cyber Monday, there's Small Business Saturday. They created this. They support it. That's selling through service. And you don't have to do it that scale. Any business can sell through service. You just have to sort of start with the customer in mind and how you can help them. And by the way, it could be just make them laugh.
Yes. Yeah.
I knew a logistics company. I don't talk about this in the book, a Canadian logistics company who built their business simply by having comedy on their website.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was nothing funny about the business.
Right, right. Well, let's get on to this final thing that I started with, okay. the S, the scientific part of cats.
Yep.
And just talk briefly in our remaining time about how can a marketer go about measuring what matters? How can they go about determining what matters? We've touched on it a bit, but if you could say a bit more about some of the things that you could measure.
Yeah. So you can measure everything. That's the problem.
It's yes.
Just like everything in this book is about how do we simplify things? How do we get rid of things? And one of the complaints that CMOs often face, and this is amateur hour, it doesn't happen that often anymore, is they'll go to their board with like 50 metrics. And by the way, the board and the CEO really only care about one, revenue.
Right.
So they might care about a few. So again, we go back to, we partnered with a CFO. We've worked on metrics that are in context of what the business wants, but we're also saying, all right, marketing can have an impact on employees, on customers, on prospects. And then there's this thing called brand. And in the book, I talk about these blended metrics that you can create on the cheap for employees, for customers, for prospects. And that's mainly philosophically measuring what matters. You got to have this so you can understand employee satisfaction, customer advocacy, and prospect interest. And if you don't have at least one, if not two metrics in those four buckets, you're going to be missing what marketing can truly do. And you're going to be stuck in this drive revenue cycle that is ultimately not very, it's problematic, as we've talked about.
Mm-hmm. And you talk in the book about the different ways to measure your brand health. But I've got to add in here, I mean, there's a little bit of math. Not, you know, we're not talking calculus here, but you remind readers of things that you should be trying to measure. Don't wait for the CFO to bring this to you, but like customer acquisition cost or lifetime value or net new logo, sales qualified leads, marketing source pipeline, all great stuff. And you could even be bringing forward to the C-suite some of these things that they may not know to ask for. Again, back to the Barta Barwise idea of teaching folks. So just a couple of the things from the towards the end of the book, you've got a whole chapter on tech, you know, MarTech, automation, and I couldn't find it. I guess I didn't mark it up, but there was a joke from about the problem of using the term automation with this software because it's not really automated. Can you explain that? That that's like a popular myth that we don't have to do anything. No.
Yeah. So the thing that kills me, and this is where, it reminds me of a sort of Monty Python, like asking, you talk to the marketer today, and particularly one that came up through sort of data or demand gen, they'll say, hey, let me show you my tech stack. And it's like, really? Because what Forrester found is that about $19 billion is being wasted on technology. And the reason is that almost every technology requires a 3-to-1, $1 for the technology and $3 in people to take advantage of it.
At minimum, it seems.
And so what happens is they bring on marketing automation and they give half a headcount without bringing anybody who understands how to do it. And then they just keep adding because there's so many cool technologies out there.
Oh, yeah. Every one of them is seductive in its own way, all 8,000 of them.
Oh, my God. And you go, I want that. And the truth is, it's like, yeah, but are you going to make sure? When I brought this up with CMOs, it's interesting because they get a little defensive about it. And they'll say, well, there are some that actually save us time. We go, great. Okay. But how many don't? And how many really, like marketing automation, you need a lot of people to make that work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of part one of this thing. The other part of it is when you get all these people into the weeds doing all this stuff, they end up measuring clicks and stuff and they get lost. And so you need a philosophy for your MarTech stack and an approach and what it is that you want to measure. Again, it all comes back to that. But then, you know, if you're spending more than 10% on your marketing technology, because marketing technology isn't marketing.
Right.
Right? I mean, when we worked on Listerine, we had to keep our production budget under 10% of the whole thing. That was a rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're fighting, if you can keep your marketing technology stack under 10%, you're a hero, which is stupid. Right?
Yeah.
Because it's like that money, if you're spending 20% on technology, I go, well, that's 10% you could have put into marketing to build awareness at least, or do something amazing. But instead, so anyway.
Let me add to that, because you talk about Forrester recommends shifting the $19 billion previously earmarked for technologies to more creative efforts to gain $10 billion more in ROI. In other words, what was it? You said, I think at one point you said a great rule of thumb is to make sure that the technology is only about 10% of your marketing budget, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's, it's a good number. I'd love to see it 5%. But there is some good stuff out there. And again, I think once you scale it down, and what one of the things a book does is say, hey, do an audit, go in and check what you've got and make sure that you're getting the value you wanted out of it. And the thing that's so interesting about marketing technology is marketing technologists are really good marketers. They are so good. And that's part of the problem, is that they're so good at marketing and doing a lot of these things that it is seductive. And so these things just keep, oh, I could use that, and that will allow me to tell a better story to my CEO. And then instead it's just like, no, you just took money out of your budget. So anyway, that's automate attentively. And in the book, there's a how to do an audit, and there's a lot. And by the way, I do at the end acknowledge that there's no looking back. I'm not a Luddite. You got to have this stuff.
Right. And half of that chapter is about, okay, now that we've established this, which is what we're really talking about here, you say, now there are great things that marketing technology can do for you, but keep, take a more sober approach to this. And it's just, is it really that different from somebody who buys a gym membership in January thinking that's going to help them lose weight? The problem is they actually have to go to the gym and exercise.
Yeah, there's that.
Right. Well, let me just ask you about two other things, and I appreciate all the extra time you're spending with us. One is about testing, and explain this expression, testing to triumph. And you even talk about a great idea is to set aside 10% of your budget for experimentation. That's a trademark move of the renegade marketer. But testing to triumph, I love that. Explain what that's all about. And do you not see as much testing as you think there should be?
Well, I don't see enough marketers put 10 to 20% of their budget into testing. And that's problematic. And it was particularly problematic if you didn't have tests going during the pandemic or right before the pandemic. And I tell the story of one CMO who had a test going that was about 20% of her budget. And then that became 80% as of March 15th. And fortunately, she had the test. But another CMO talks about these little bets that can become big bets.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because look, you know, part of the scientific method is great. You have something that's working for you. You've tested your way to get there. But there's always something else that you can try. And I'm not saying have 20 tests, by the way. But one of the things that a lot of companies are doing right now is testing ABM. And in the process of testing ABM, by the way, they're finding this is really hard to make it work. And so you have to get all the kinks out in ABM to make it work. And when you do, it can be amazing, assuming you get all the kinks out. But that's a good small bet that could become a big bet. And part of this also is this culture of experimentation. The part about chief marketing officer that I really think about is the chief. You're a leader. You are the person who is making marketing something really important in the organization. And if you're building a culture of experimentation, you're going to keep your employees longer, and you have to be able to celebrate successes and failures. And I talk about that in the book, but it's so fun. That's the fun part of this.
Yes.
Thing.
Yes. So true. And I can't remember which book, because you've whipped me into a renegade marketing frenzy in this conversation. But there was one recently where a great question for a CEO or whoever's approving a marketing plan or a budget or whatever is to ask, okay, what are you going to be testing this year?
Yeah.
That's a great question to sort of become the straw that stirs the drink of, you know, I'm not a marketer, I'm the CEO, but you should be testing things. And it also seems to give such great air cover to the marketers. And whenever we've pitched something to a client, we say, well, this is going to be a test. And we want to learn. It's not a silver bullet that's going to deliver us from evil. So now you mentioned ABM. That's the last thing I want to ask you about. You write very important words here on page 146. Account-based marketing is not something that can be ignored in the B2B marketing space. And you go on to talk about a conversation you had with Peter Isaacson, who was then the CMO of Demandbase. And on the next page, I was wondering if you could talk about the three big mistakes he sees from companies that are struggling with ABM implementation.
Yes. So number one is not engaging the sales department in new strategies. That kind of goes back to the welcome right. Part of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can't, ABM is a partnership, period, end of story. And if you don't, if you try to do it from the marketing department, it will fail. Just don't. They really have to be equally invested because part of ABM is, okay, we picked 100 accounts. We're going to go after those 100 accounts. When the intent signals are happening, if sales guys are going, oh, I'm working my own leads, it fails.
Yeah.
So the second one is not aligning with the right target accounts. And so here's, you know, in any direct marketing thing, by the way, it's always 60% is the data, right? Do you have the right people in your database? And so not aligning on the right target accounts mean you're just going after the wrong people. And so that's going to fail. It always does. And then the third one is tackling too many areas of ABM all at once. There's a lot you can do with ABM. There's mm-hmm. so many add-ons that live on top of this, and you can integrate so many cool things. It's amazing when it's working really well, but it takes time to learn each of those technologies and to make sure that you're getting the most of it. It goes back to automating attentively. It's like if you know, sometimes I got a new car a few years ago. It took me weeks to figure out how to just use the system.
Oh yeah.
Right? Because like, I just want to make a phone call.
Right. No, I know what you're talking about. My wife got a new car a few years ago and I couldn't figure out how to turn it on.
Right. So, you know, and ABM is there's some amazing, again, as I said, there are a lot of add-ons in it, but don't try to do it all at once. Do it in building blocks. And then we circle right back to the salespeople. And do we agree? We've added this. Did it work? Are we comfortable? Great. We'll add another one.
Yes.
So there you are, ABM.
So, Drew, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
So, we talked a lot about the CATS framework, and I think that's it. What I really want to do is make their life easier and more gratifying. And so, just take a piece of paper, write down four quadrants, put courageous, artful, thoughtful, and scientific, and see if you can put two things in each of those boxes. Are you know, is your strategy courageous? Are you artfully ideating? Have you sort of found your point of distinction? Are you executing on a thoughtful basis? And do you have the right metrics in place and testing, right? If you have all of those, amen. And if you don't have, can't put one or two actions in each of those, then, you know, you need to re-look at your priorities because that's really how we radically simplify and become a renegade marketer.
Mm. That's great advice, and that's something somebody can do today. So looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
Okay, so first I have to say Autobiography of Ben Franklin, of course. He's sort of an original American-made, you know, a Horatio Alger story of mm-hmm. arriving in Philadelphia at a young age and with pennies in his pocket. And I'll stay in the sort of pantheon of things and Lincoln on Leadership. If you've never read that, I pull that out all the time in terms of just reminding myself what's a good leader do. Now I'm going to give you one that you're not going to expect, which is The Joys of Yiddish. And like you, I'm a fan of dad humor and the book is crammed with it. And so I just love to and it sits very close to here and just take a break and look and, oh, that's funny. I didn't know that the definition of a schmozzle was the guy who the schmeal falls onto when he falls out of a window. That's just a funny story. And then lastly,
by Leo Rosten.
Yes.
Oh,
Joys of Yiddish. hilarious.
Anything I could do to get my adult children to continue rolling their eyes at dad's stupid jokes. It's one of my life missions.
Oh my God, they're all in there. And then the lastly is Nuts, which is about the founding of Southwest Airlines. Great story about building an employee culture that ultimately drives the brand. Just phenomenal story.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I didn't know that. I could understand the name of the book though. Well, that's great. Well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
I finished recently How Not to Suck at Marketing by my friend Jeff Perkins.
I've heard about that book.
Yeah. So Jeff is one of the few CMOs who became a CEO, and it's a really fun read. And if you'll see why he became a CEO, because he's just an incredibly engaging, empathetic human. And it's a great personal story. And then I'm sort of halfway through Dan Genghis's The Experience Maker. It's just got some great sort of customer experience moments, and I'm only halfway through. So he has an acronym. I've only gotten through two of the letters.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually interviewing him about that next week. I'm looking forward to having him back on the show.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. I'm doing a podcast with Dan or something with CMO Huddles upcoming soon. So it's very cool.
Oh, good, good. Now, Jeff Perkins, you mentioned him in the book, I think. He's with the parking software company.
Park Mobile. Yeah. You talk about their business during the pandemic. Oh my gosh. This is a guy who spent a lot of time building a strong employee culture. And boy, did that matter when the pandemic struck, because their business stopped. Nobody was driving into a city to park, and they're in the parking business.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I actually heard about that book from Carla Johnson, whose new book is Rethink Innovation. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including a number of interviews that have been on the Marketing Book Podcast that I've mentioned, like all the folks that endorsed your book and Jay Baer's, those two interviews for those two books, and include links to your site, including Renegade Marketer. Is that it?
It's renegademarketing.com. Renegade, goes straight to the book.
Right. Renegademarketing.com. And that's got some really cool extras, bonuses. I just downloaded five of them. One of them I mentioned was all the books, but you can sign up for the newsletter and get extras for the book. Include links to your LinkedIn profile and your Twitter profile. And the reason I'm doing that is so that if you, the listener, would please do me a big favor and reach out to Drew and thank him for being on the Marketing Book Podcast. There's lots of podcasts out there. He spent a lot of time with us talking about his great book. Please swarm him and thank him. And if nothing else, thank him for putting up with this knuckleheaded podcaster and his really stupid, immature jokes. So, and if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. The book is Renegade Marketing, 12 Steps to Building Unbeatable B2B Brands. The author is Drew Neiser. Drew, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh my gosh, Douglas, my pleasure. So you're doing amazing work. Keep going. I'm going to have to read all these books now.
Sorry about that.
I know.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And remember the words of the entrepreneur and author Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.